It was early springtime and the strike was on. It drove us miners out of doors, out from the houses that the company owned. We moved into tents up at Old Ludlow.
It's the Ludlow Massacre by Woody Guthrie. It was 100 years ago this month that an attack by the Colorado National Guard and Colorado Fuel and Iron Company camp guards on a tent colony of more than 1,200 striking coal miners and their families in Ludlow, Colorado. It resulted in the deaths of almost 40 people, including women and 11 children. This month, we're taking a look back at Ludlow, what happened, and the legacy of Ludlow for our state of Colorado. And this morning, I'm delighted to welcome David Mason, Colorado Poet Laureate and author of the novel in verse, Ludlow. He joins us now this morning from our sister station in Colorado Springs, KRCC. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you with us. And before we get into talk about Ludlow and your work on that, first of all, I know that your tenure as Poet Laureate for the state of Colorado is wrapping up this year. What has it been like for you for the past 4 years?
Well, it's been a real honor and a great opportunity to get to learn something about where I live. I've been to most counties in the state. I think I've been through about 60 of the 64 counties. I've met a great many people from all kinds of backgrounds. I've spent a lot of time in schools, a little bit of time in correctional institutions and all kinds of other organizations. And I've just learned a lot about the state, about its history, about its landscapes. And it's been a real honor. It's been a delight.
And what role do you think that the Poet Laureate plays for the state of Colorado and the people here?
Well, I think, first of all, it's just to recognize the role poetry actually does play in people's lives, whether they're aware of it or not. I've been making the case that articulateness is a universal human good, and that people reach for articulateness in times of need. They might be happy times, they might be in love, or they might be sad times, they might be dealing with death or political difficulties. And we need language that is flexible, articulate, precise, and beautiful in order to memorialize these moments in our lives, in order to hold them and make some sense of them. And so if poetry is part of that universal human good, then the Poet Laureate simply has the task of bringing poetry to communities, bringing other poets, and awakening poetry among young people and old people in communities all over the state, and also reminding people that poetry is more ubiquitous than they realize. It's in all kinds of popular culture. It's in movies and television and all sorts of things. So it's around them much more than they might realize. I was just listening to the tail end of the Naropa performances on your station, and it was just delightful to hear the interface between poetry and music. And that's just one of the good ways of reminding people how important these things are in their lives.
Well, one of the stories of our state that you have articulated through poetry is the story of Ludlow, and you've done it through, maybe it's unusual, I'll ask you to tell us about that, a novel-length poem, essentially, or a book and verse. How would you best describe your work, Ludlow?
Well, it's I called it a verse novel, and there are a number of verse novels in print by various people. The more I think about it, the more I realize that it also partakes of the oldest tradition of storytelling in human cultures. That's the epic, you know, which goes back to Gilgamesh in Mesopotamia, not to mention Homer and Virgil and Milton. There's a wonderful Irish poet you may know, Patrick Cavanaugh, who has a poem called Epic, which is about two farmers arguing over a field, arguing over a piece of land. And Kavanaugh's wondering whether what's going on in Europe at large, in Munich, with the Munich bother, as he calls it, is more important than two Irish farmers arguing over a field, until he hears sort of the ghost of Homer saying, "I made the Iliad, out of such a local row. And that really is what we're dealing with here. The Iliad and the Odyssey are local stories that have come to take on national and international implications and importance. So epic, if it still exists in the modern world, and if Ludlow partakes of epic to some extent, is a local story that takes on large proportions. And I do think Ludlow, the story of Ludlow, whether in my version or just in the many versions that exist, is a kind of epic of America, because it's a story about this experiment in personhood that is America, the desire of people to believe that they are legitimate, that they have a right to exist, a right to live here. And it's also a story about ruthless corporate power and violence. And I think America is a particularly violent nation in many respects. You know, the Ludlow Massacre is one symptom of that. So between the stories of immigrants, the struggles of individuals to assert their own validity as people, the repressive powers of corporations in this country, I think you've got a good deal of the essence of America in this story.
And of course, those stories are still being told today in many ways.
That's right.
Immigrants,
yeah.
And the struggles against corporations and corporate power. And we'll talk a little bit later on about the legacy of Ludlow and really the parallels between some of the stories that we are seeing continuing today. But talk about your personal interaction with the story. How did you first come across the story of Ludlow? Because you're not originally from Colorado, obviously. You've been living here for many years and you are our poet laureate. How did you first come across the story?
Well, both my parents were from Colorado. My great-grandfather settled in southern Colorado in the late 19th century. He was postmaster of Walsenburg. He actually ran one of the notorious company stores that cheated the miners in the early 20th century. And then he moved away from that. And by well before the time of Ludlow, he was a, quote, legitimate businessman, end quote, in Trinidad. He was a man who dealt in property and had a partnership in a creamery that later became a candy company. By about 1911, he was making candy. In fact, if you go to Trinidad and you walk down among the brick buildings down by the Purgatory River, you can still see the fading letters of Mason Candy Company on one of the old buildings down there off Commercial Street. Anyway, George Mason, I never met, but I met his son, Abraham, my grandfather. And when I was a kid, we would come down from Washington State to visit Abraham and Ethel and my Uncle Frank, who later ran the candy company, wonderful man, great storyteller. My Uncle Tom, who lived in Boulder and had something to do with planning at the university there for some years. And I remember driving down the road from Boulder to Trinidad, probably in the late 50s. I would have been quite young. And I remember my father and my uncle pointing to the hills around Ludlow and mentioning machine guns being trained on the miners there. Now, my family was, you know, politically relatively neutral in terms of this story, but they felt a real righteous anger at what had happened there. And great sympathy with the strikers. And so the story was part of my family's history, part of my family's lore as I grew up. Many years later, my Uncle Tom had moved to Minneapolis, and he was moving off to Ireland to go live in the Barra Peninsula and run a bed and breakfast, which he did for the last 20 years of his life or so. And Tom was giving away books, and he gave me George McGovern's book, The Great Coalfield War, which was McGovern's PhD dissertation in history that was rewritten in a more popular form with a co-author. I read McGovern's book and I thought, well, that's a heck of a story. Maybe I can do something with that someday. I lived 20 years away from the West. I lived in Minnesota for a while. I lived in New York. I lived in Greece. I lived in Pennsylvania. When I finally got a job that allowed me to come back to the West. I teach at Colorado College now, my alma mater. I was so glad to be back in a landscape that I knew, where I knew the names of the mountains and the rivers, and I knew some of the lore of the place, that I wanted to ground myself in this place. And I thought of the Ludlow story again. And then I read Zis Papanicolaou's great book, Buried Unsung, Louis Tikas and the Ludlow Massacre, and I read some other stuff. And I realized that Greek immigrants had a huge role to play in this. And I happened to have lived in Greece, and I speak Greek. And I happened at the time to have been married to a Scottish immigrant. I had my Scottish mother-in-law in the house. I was hearing the accents of Ayrshire. So I felt ideally situated to take on this story in a way that perhaps nobody else could. I knew something about the consciousness of being an immigrant, the dividedness one feels, the way one dreams in one language and wakes to another, the way one feels one's personhood challenged in some ways by the environment one's in. And so I thought I had all the elements of the story. I didn't want it to be a documentary. I wanted it to be an imaginative dreamscape, a novel. But I felt perfectly natural about writing it in verse. I'd been writing a lot of narrative and dramatic poetry in verse. And when I sat down one day to write, I just found myself falling into blank verse. Shot firers filed in after the diggers left and found the marked drills for their measured shot. As daylight died, the men were blasting deep for the next day's cuts of coal, while down below the mesa, smells of cooking rose from shacks and rows. And there Louisa scrubbed the pot as if she were some miner's wife and not a sapper's daughter, scrawny, barely 12. It was falling right into a language that's utterly natural in English, a measure that's utterly natural in English. And it gave me a way of moving into and moving through the story. So that's how I got personally involved, and I even decided to make myself, as it were, a kind of character, or make a version of myself, weave in and out of the story, commenting on how the story is told. And that's been a rather controversial aspect of the book, but I think it works.
That's Colorado's current poet laureate, David Mason. He's also the co-director of the creative writing program at Colorado College in Colorado Springs. He's joining us now from the studios of KRCC in Colorado Springs here at KGNU. And we're talking about Ludlow. It's his novel in verse, and it's part of our month-long look at the 100-year anniversary of the Ludlow Massacre. Well, David, you've said that you have parts fiction, parts fact. Which characters from the actual events are in your book, and why did you choose to either include those and exclude some of the others?
Yeah, that's a great question. I did it all instinctively. I've always loved historical fiction. I mean, I remember adoring Tolstoy, War and Peace, when I was young. And that's, you know, Napoleon shows up as a character in that book, and General Kutuzov, and historical figures of various kinds. But it's really Tolstoy's effort to understand his own family and understand his own parents, who he never really knew because they died when he was young. So War and Peace is the epic of Russia, but it's also a personal story. And so I felt I was doing something similar. I wanted to move into the book, and I wanted to have absolute freedom in the manner in which I moved into the book. So I begin with a fictional character, this little girl, Louisa Mole, who grows up in the course of the book. I have a fictional character named Too Tall McIntosh, who's one of my favorite characters in the book. He's an Ayrshireman, and maybe in some distant way he resembles members of my own family. And I have a number of other fictional characters I'm very fond of, but the story takes as its outline actual events in history, just as War and Peace does. And so I had to make use of historical figures, or at least I felt I did. And the major historical figure in the book is this marvelous Cretan immigrant, Louis Tikas. And Louis was one of my inroads to the story, because I felt I could understand the dream life and the inner life of a Greek immigrant. His real name was Ilias Bandidakis. He grew up in Lutra, a little village outside Rethymnon in Crete. I've now been to his house. I've seen where he grew up. At the time I wrote the book, I hadn't been there yet. And Zis Papanikolaos and others and I have talked quite a bit about my version of Louis, whether he's historically accurate or not. I gave myself the freedom to make this character probably a bit more sensitive and tortured than the actual man really was. We do know that Louis was trying to keep the peace on the day of the massacre, and that does suggest that he had a sensitive side in some respects. But he was also probably a pretty tough Cretan who knew a thing or two about shooting. There are other historical figures. Mother Jones is in the book, the great rabble-rouser for the Union, marvelous character, an Irish immigrant. John D. Rockefeller Jr. Appears obliquely in the book. Governor Ammons, the feckless Democrat who called in the National Guard. General John Chase, the Denver ophthalmologist who rather stupidly commanded the troops around Trinidad and at one point actually ordered a ridiculous charge of mounted soldiers against unarmed women who were protesting the incarceration of Mother Jones. You know, so these are marvelous, marvelous characters. But I was very careful not to, for the most part, make the historical figures the central figures in the story, except for Louis Tikas, because I wanted that freedom to get inside their heads. So I wanted to use my invented characters for the most part as the central figures in the story.
Do you feel a responsibility when you are writing about actual characters, albeit if they're not going to be the central characters in the story, but do you feel a responsibility to tell their story in a way that is true to them, given the fact that this happened 100 years ago and you can't talk to them?
I feel a responsibility to the truth, but I think the truth is sometimes difficult to put your finger on. And that's actually part of what the book is about. The book is really about memory and storytelling as much as anything else. It's about how we make meaning out of these events in our lives. So my responsibility, first and foremost, was to make it vivid and alive and intense and moving. So what you might say is that if I am not always entirely accurate historically, I am accurate psychologically and emotionally. And I do think that's a legitimate way of getting at this kind of truth. Historical books that have been written about Ludlow are in some ways different from mine. Scott Martell's Blood Passion, Zeese's book, and George McGovern's book, and others. But the truth is, what's interesting is that even at times when I thought I might have been making up details, for example, details about what it's like to work down in the mines, where I've never been in my life, and I had to imagine things, it turns out I was pretty accurate. People have come up and told me that that I got it right. And that's kind of gratifying, you know. There were a couple of small details about mining equipment that I got wrong in the first edition of the book, 2007. So I did correct a couple of those details. I just wanted to make sure I had the language right. And I do think historical novelists are often pretty meticulous about those things, too.
That's our current state poet laureate, David Mason. He's joining us here at KGNU to talk about Ludlow. He wrote in 2007 a verse novel about the massacre that happened 100 years ago on April 20th, when striking miners and their families were fired upon by the Colorado National Guard and many were killed. All this month on KGNU, we're taking a look back at 100 years of Ludlow. David Mason, you wrote this in 2007. It was kind of just before the economic meltdown, although things were happening at that point. At that point, were you aware of what would become a real national anger against large corporations. Did you have anger when you were actually writing this about what was happening in present time?
Yes, I did. You have to remember this is also, you know, it was being written during the two Bush administrations. You know, I mean, the two George Bush, the younger, in the early years of the 21st century, and I had plenty of anger, not just about corporate greed, but also about pretty much the management of almost every aspect of American politics, and so it's an angry book. There's just no getting away from that. And it is interesting, isn't it, that others were working on the same story at the same time. I should mention Thomas Andrews, the wonderful historian at the University of Colorado in Denver, who published a terrific history of the whole struggle called Killing for Coal. So Tom Andrews was at work on his book. Scott Martell was at work on his book. Zeese had really pioneered everything for us with his book. So it was in the air. People were dealing with this. Eleanor Swanson, a poet at Regis University in Denver, had published a wonderful book called A Trembling in the Bones, and also about Ludlow and events surrounding it. So something was in the air, and it's interesting how much of this was being done before the crash, as it were, and how much, you know, our anger was justified.
When you've been traveling around the state these past 4 years in your role as poet laureate, speaking to different people in different communities, have you come across an awareness about what happened, the coalfield wars, specifically Ludlow, as we're talking about that today? Because one of the criticisms that I've heard is that this is not the history that's being taught in public schools. You mentioned Thomas Andrews, when he's been on to talk about his book, he said, no, this is the history that should be taught, but it's very often excluded. What's been your experience when you're out in communities talking to them? What is the memory of Ludlow?
Well, it's pretty much Tom's experience. There are exceptions. If you go down to Trinidad and Walsenburg, people know the story. They may not have learned it in school, but they know the story because their families are involved. And in fact, it's a little bit like walking into a pub in Ulster 20 years ago and having to decide whether you're going to use the word Londonderry or the word Derry. You have to be very careful who you're talking to. Because people are very passionate about this story on both sides of it. I know people who voted against Barack Obama in the last election because they thought he would suppress the coal industry. You know, I know people who are very, very active in union politics and people on both sides of the issue. And the family history goes way back. There are descendants of the victims of the Ludlow Massacre living here in the state, and the memory is long. Having said that, in most places in the state where I've given readings from the book or talks about history and poetry, people have said they're surprised to hear it and that nobody talked about it in school. Why don't they talk about it in school? I'm hoping that the governor's commission help remember the Ludlow Massacre will have something to do with changing the curriculum in Colorado schools. I think the story of Ludlow and issues like it was actively suppressed by corporations, powerful corporations with connections in government. But I also think that in trying economic times, people can be afraid of stories that suggest, you know, that they might lose their jobs or that they might fall on hardship if the stories get out, if they get told. So it's, you know, it's a story that needs to be told. I agree with Tom, and I'm very, very glad that you and others are helping us tell the story.
Is there a danger when this story is now being told, particularly with the passage of time, now we're 100 years later, that either the facts will change or there are certain rose tint will go gloss might happen over the story themselves. I know the people who were killed, murdered essentially, are now really kind of thought about as martyrs, and there's very much the casting of the others in the evil role, John D. Rockefeller, the Colorado National Guard. But what about some of the other nuances? Because I know that you don't let the Union off the hook, although unions themselves were fighting for a good cause. There was a lot going on there that you want to draw attention to.
Yeah, I point out that the Union was also corrupt and violent. Scott Martell has demonstrated in his book that it's probably true that strikers killed more people in the course of the year of the strike than National Guard troops did. Among the strikers, many of the Greeks were well-armed and quite good at fighting, having participated in the Balkan Wars against the Bulgarians and the Turks. My book is it takes great pains not to make an angel of anyone, and I don't believe in innocence. Actually, I don't really believe it exists, and I think it's kind of a dangerous concept. As much as I don't let the Union off the hook, I certainly don't let John D. Rockefeller Jr. off the hook. He may have been relatively ignorant of some of the decisions made in his name, but he hired and approved of the people who made those decisions in his name. The fact that he had started the Rockefeller Foundation a year before the Ludlow Massacre, and that he was giving away some of his fortune and all that sort of stuff, doesn't let him off the hook for the way his managers ran the company. Which was ruthless made mining in southern Colorado extremely dangerous.
David Mason is Colorado's state poet laureate, at least until this year anyway. His tenure will pass on to somebody else. He joined us this morning from the studios in Colorado Springs, KRCC. Thanks to Andrea Chalfin there for engineering. This is part of our month-long look at the 100th year anniversary of the Ludlow Massacre here at KGNU. As we transition out, David, could you maybe finish up with a reading, maybe just a small segment from your book, Ludlow, the verse novel looking at the massacre?
Here's just two stanzas about Louis Tikas. And before I read them, I'd like to mention that I'll be reading at Innisfree Bookstore in Boulder Saturday night at 7. So if any listeners want to hear some more poetry, I'll be there. This is about Louis Tikas, just two stanzas. Tikas, awake, surprised to feel such grief, tasted the salt of tears that came in dreams, and knew what he had missed was almost freedom. Years ago in sunlight, when he drank the virgin pressing of the oil like wine at his father's house, oh God, he missed the sea, the tears of an eternity of men, the peacefulness of swimming under water. He missed the smell of grass and autumn rain, the sacks of dripping goat cheese hung from rafters, the words like thalassa and uranos that felt to him much weightier than English. Words in American were cardboard words, cast-offs of language naming nothing real. Something was wrong here, something very wrong with the people who could never sing for joy.
That's David Mason reading from his verse novel, Ludlow. He'll be reading at the Innisfree Bookstore in Boulder on the Hill this coming Saturday evening. Thank you very much for being with us this morning, David.
Thank you, Maeve. My pleasure.
And you can go to our website, kgnu.org, for more information on Ludlow and a link to a show that we kicked off our month of coverage last week on It's the Economy last Thursday evening. Stay tuned. We're going to have Uncle Jeff bringing us a great morning of music and the Morning Sound Alternative, and we'll go out with Woody Guthrie and the Ludlow Massacre. Thanks for listening to KGNU. I've been your host, Maeve Conran.
Soldiers waited till all us miners was asleep. You snuck around our little tent town, soaked our tents with your kerosene. You struck a match and the blaze it started. You pulled the triggers.